Welcome to Australia's Fiercely Independent Property Podcast.
Residential property is the only asset class we live in. It is where we raise our families, and it's our most expensive investment, yet property advice remains unregulated.
Listen to three pioneers of the property industry, each with diverse areas of expertise in property planning, buying, and education.
We'll distill the raw truth from the ill-informed.
Join the property planner, David Johnston, the property buyer, Kate Bakos.
That's me.
And the property professor, Peter Kalizos, as we take you on a journey through the maze of property, mortgage and money decisions to empower you to create your ideal lifestyle.
Hello and welcome everyone to the Property Planner, Buyer and Professor podcast. It's lovely to have you back again, and also very lovely to have my two co-hosts, Dave Johnston and Kate Bakos. Kate, how are you?
Yeah, doing well, Pete. I actually enjoyed a little Easter break and it was divine. It just felt like all of the agents in my patch decided they'd take a break and we genuinely got a bit of R&R. It was good.
Excellent. Dave, how about you? How are you going?
Yeah, we had a great break down at my auntie and uncle's farm outside of Dunkeld and went yabbing with the boys and rounded up some sheep and climbed up Mount Sturgeon in the Grampians. It was a great little getaway.
Fantastic. I don't know what the weather was like there, but in Adelaide, like I don't remember an Easter weekend like we've just had. We went to the beach Friday and Saturday and then we went to McLaren Vale on the Monday, but about 30 degrees every day, no wind, sunshine, unbelievable, unbelievable. Fantastic
yeah.
weekend.
Yeah, we hit 30 around here too.
Yeah, all right. Yep, got very spoiled.
It's that time where we provide our listeners with a market update. And we all know that, you know, the market is zooming up, but we're going to give our listeners a few more insights into that. But before we do, Dave, you posted something on social media yesterday, which I found astonishing. Maybe I shouldn't have because I should keep my eye on the national property market more. But two things I found astonishing. One, the median value of dwellings in Hobart, so that's houses and units, is higher than it is in Brisbane and Perth. So it goes Sydney, the most expensive, then Melbourne, then Canberra, then Hobart. And Darwin is the cheapest capital city in Australia. Having said that, Darwin has had 14% growth in the last 12 months, but it's still at the bottom of the table. So unfortunately for people that own property in Darwin, it did plummet quite a bit. But the good news is, it's coming back as it is all over the country.
It's really interesting, isn't it? Hobart's median of 548,000, despite its tiny population, being the equivalent of Brisbane's and greater than Perth, Adelaide and Darwin's. So what do we put that down to?
Well, I'd like to get Kate's opinion because she owns investment property, and then I'm going to let you know why I think that is the case.
Yeah, okay. Well, let's talk about it. We all know Hobart. We know and love it. You don't get so many blocks of apartments down there. You know, we haven't got towers and one-bedders in the sky. So if you're looking at median, you're talking about the midpoint of the data. And there's a lot more houses as a percentage of total dwellings in Hobart. There is apartments. And that's my first point. The second one is we all know it's flying. Everyone loves it. We've got people taking money down there. Now that we're bound to domestic travel only for a while, it's been a favourite little destination for a lot of people who would ordinarily have, you know, pretty hefty budgets for holiday. And also we have to always question data. Now we're talking about a particular segment. It doesn't necessarily mean that it will be sustained. You can introduce anomalies. It's a smaller city. So if they've had, you know, one particular type of dwelling really get on the boil, then that can skew data as well. But I maintain that it's not as rounded out with lots of apartments as places like Melbourne and Brisbane and Sydney are.
Yeah, that's a great point. Both of those points are really good points, actually. I mean, its population is smaller, so it's more open to the data being skewed because it's got a smaller set of numbers to work with. So that's a really good point. Pete, what are your thoughts?
Well, my words of wisdom are it's people with money that drive the property market and they don't necessarily have to live there. So that's why places like Portsea and Sorrento are quite expensive, even though they have relatively small populations. It's the wealthy generally that live in Melbourne that buy property in Portsea and Sorrento. Same can be said for Byron Bay in New South Wales. Same can be said for Noosa in Queensland. It's the people with the money that drive the property market. And I suspect that there are people from mainland Australia, some relatively wealthy people, that have decided to buy property in Hobart for whatever reason. Maybe it's semi-retirement, retirement, could be a holiday house, like Kate said. You know, we've been restricted to flying overseas, so the ability to fly to Hobart for the weekend or a week of your holidays is quite appealing. And on a larger scale, that's what was happening a few years ago before the government brought in their foreign investor levy. When relatively wealthy investors were buying in Australia, they were forcing property prices up. They weren't necessarily living here. They were just buying investment property. So that's what I think it is. I reckon it's the wealthier people buying property in Hobart for a number of different reasons.
That's probably my what I think is the prime driver, although I also agree with Kate's 2 points as well. And I think there's a level of overseas investment that's disproportionate to the size of Hobart, the population of Hobart. And I think that is certainly playing a part down there, and it'll be interesting to see. It's a really hard one to predict how long that will continue and if it'll, you know, this is actually where Hobart's going to continue to sit for the long term or whether there'll be some sort of change. We know it's sort of ridden up and then it's plateaued for a long time and then risen up. But this rise is really, you know, I didn't think it would continue past, I guess, where it started to seemingly plateau prior to COVID, but it's taken off again, hasn't it, in the last period. So do you think it's sustainable?
Yeah, I do. I used to say no. I'd always say, oh, you know, you've got to follow where the jobs are. But as Pete's just said, and I completely agree, if people with money are buying down there for lifestyle, well, the lifestyle fun is abundant in Hobart. You've had Mona essentially put it on the map, and I know a lot of people down there might disagree with me. You've got the taste of Tasmania. The dock area just has a wonderful buzz every weekend. I mean, I used to go down to Tassie, and the only times you'd hear a pub making a bit of noise was on a Friday or a Saturday night, and it was ghost town. Now, it's not like that anymore. And if you're looking for amazing food and wine and beautiful experiences, that it's definitely in abundance down there. And you can get out of Hobart and travel the whole island, and it's the most gorgeous destination. That's not changing. And the more money that goes down there, the more these facilities will cater to that kind of money, and then the more people with extra money will continue coming down. It's a vicious cycle. So yeah. I think we're going to see something that's here to stay.
And what we've got, Tasmania offers things for a number of people, in particular those that are looking for the natural environment, you know, beautiful scenery down there, but also the built environment. Like you mentioned, Mona, Constitution Dock. I think Hobart's the prettiest city. It's got wonderful architecture. So it's got something for everyone, older people, younger people, if you're into sailing, if you're into great food. Tassie does offer a lot of great stuff. So, yeah, I think it's going to continue.
And the natural resources boom as well, I think, plays a part. And people's desire for the beauty of nature, I think, is increasing as well. And Hobart and Tassie is becoming a place on the world map for a number of the reasons you've already said, plus, you know, its natural resources and beauty.
Clean and green, and lots more people, especially globally, are looking for that sort of label, and Tasmania certainly has that. All right, what about some other parts of Australia in our market update? What are you seeing, Kate? What's happening?
Well, I love seeing that the data lag coming through. You know, I look, the first city I look at is my city, which, you know, is a fair call because that's where I work and I'm very active in Melbourne. But, you know, 4.9 for the quarter, or when we look at the month, Melbourne did 2.4%. This is still old data. But I've been saying, not in a cavalier fashion, in a bit of a panicked fashion, that it feels like we're doing a percent a week. Now, the reality is I've gone back through all of my analysis and data for this year. So for 2021, I've now got 3 complete months that I've been able to look at. And in my defence, we worked right through January. So it's been 3 active months with auction and purchase activity. And it looks like we've been doing a percent a fortnight.
A fortnight, right.
Yep. Yeah.
So do you know, I'll tell you something that reflects that, and it might even be part of the reason why you feel that, is there's actually Domain put out some stats on auction medians. And the properties that go to auction, for those who don't know, generally are the more sought after properties because, you know, we feel like that an auction is going to bring the most competitive buying animal spirits out in people to really drive up prices. So what's really interesting is like the growth in Melbourne median auction price over the last 12 months has been 18%, according to Domain. And obviously a lot more of the properties you're attending, Kate, are auctions or pre-sold pre-auction, which is also at record levels. And Sydney median auction price has jumped by 17%. So actually 1% less than Melbourne's over the last 12 months. So I think that's a really interesting statistic because it probably better reflects what we feel like we've been seeing and watching over the last year. That's 18% and 17% where the actual overall data isn't, and these algorithms are only reflecting, you know, much lower number growth. What are your two takes on that?
My cross-section of acquisitions spans beyond auction, and I work on lower level, high level, regional. It feels like we're doing 1% a fortnight across the board for houses.
What percentage? And so mainly auctions are mainly houses as well, so there's an interconnection there. And what percentage of your properties in Melbourne would be auctions or pre-auctions?
Probably about 60.
Yep.
We're doing a few off markets as well. But the point is it's a competitive fight. So even for an off market, it might boil down to four people fighting over it on Zoom in a simulated auction format. So the beauty of an auction is you get to count your competing bidders and you can analyze afterwards how many people were out at certain increments, and you can really evaluate whether there were two people that felt passionately about it and fought it for another $100,000, or if you had five people in the mix and they all dropped like flies in the last $20,000 worth of bidding activity. It's a fascinating study, and at the moment the surprise for me and what's very different from past years is that the number of people fighting aggressively over my point of analysis where I've determined this is likely to represent market value, we've still got a number of people fighting it past that. So the inference is that a lot of buyers are saying, I think I know what it's worth, but I'm really determined to get it and I'll fight harder for it.
Yeah, see, I would say that the median auction price more truly reflects what's happened across the broader property market, to your point. You compare and contrast Melbourne property auction values growing by 18% over the last 12 months and Sydney's by 17%, whereas if you look at the CoreLogic index, it has over the last 12 months, Sydney only up 5.4% and Melbourne up 0.7%. So that is a huge difference.
The important thing here, though, is when we're assessing 12 months worth of data whenever we're looking at annualised or rolling figures, and it's been the most marked shift ever in a 12-month period. 12 months ago, the pandemic hit, vendors were dropping like flies, no one wanted to take a property to auction. It was just an awful time. So for us to benchmark this heady period where we're getting 90% auction clearance rates with where we were under 30% and auctions were getting cancelled and sales were being put on the shelf because we could never get access, I think it's been the most incredible contrast in terms of a 12-month period ever.
Yeah, absolutely. And that's around auctions, although this is about values. And it's going back to March last year, which is pre the COVID lockdowns as well.
Yes, but bear in mind when pandemic hit, anyone who had an auction scheduled for the 14th of March, pandemic was declared 13th. I had agents ring me saying auctions have been cancelled, vendors are on pause. I had clients ring me saying, I don't want to bid tomorrow. It was a drastic time. And also we do have to look at the likelihood of a vendor saying, I've got a very significant value asset here, I might just delay this or put my plans to sell on hold. It was really only the vendors that had to sell that did sell.
Yeah, definitely that all plays into it. I still think that differential of 18% and 17% better reflects what we've been seeing on the ground.
Yeah.
Even the last quarter, Sydney 6.7, Melbourne 4.9, as per your comments, you know, you're saying it's going up by 1% a fortnight. Over what period did you faced that off since the start of this year, or?
Well, for Melbourne, it's pretty much since we reopened, but it did feel like as soon as our auction season officially started, which was the first week of Feb, someone just kind of came along and tipped a bit more fuel on the fire.
You know, there's a lot of stuff happening that I have never seen before in this particular market. And if I could give you my insight as to why I think that might be the case, but price is a function of demand and supply. And I think one of the big reasons here is that there is a lack of supply. There is nowhere near as many properties for sale today as there has been in previous years, and we are well below our 10-year average. But I think the important thing is to try and work out why. So I've been speaking to real estate agents, I've been speaking to owners, and from what I hear, there are two reasons. One, some owners are too scared to put their property on the market to sell because they're not sure if they can qualify for finance for the next one. They're not sure about their job because even though the worst of COVID-19 is over, it's not all over. That's certainly one. And the other one is, with the market going up so rapidly, if you sell today and then wait for your property to actually settle before you go and buy, and that might be 3 or 4 months' time, the market's moved up, you know, maybe 6 or 7 or 8%. Not only are you paying transaction costs to sell the property, to buy the next one, so far as stamp duty is concerned, but that you're also paying a higher price because the property market just naturally went up. So what I am seeing is a lot more people doing renovations and extensions at home because, as we were saying before, Dave, before we started recording, a lot more of your people are working from home, so they want to make their home more, you know, livable, you know, more enjoyable. They're not just there after work. They're also there during working hours, so they want to make it a more pleasant environment.
And that's one of the long-lasting changes, isn't it? Most people are going to be spending more time at home than they ever have.
Yep, definitely. And that's going to have an impact, a flow-on impact, especially like if your offices are in the CBD, there are less workers in the CBD, then we need less other businesses. We need less cafes. We need less businesses that are servicing those offices in the CBD. So it has this move of working from home some of the time is going to have a big flow-on effect in many parts of society, but also in property, in particular commercial property. Office property, I think, will have the largest negative impact, but it's also going to have effect on our own residential property because we want the homes that we live in and now work from more regularly to be a nicer environment.
Absolutely. And there's going to be, to the commercial point, more satellite offices setting up in external hubs of the different cities, or what we call hubbards, where there's, you know, major centres or junctions where people around that region of the city, and there'd already been somewhat of a trend, but that is certainly going to pick up more and more. And I've already seen some of the government organisations talking about setting up some offices in outer suburbs and middling suburbs, so all their staff don't have to be travelling into the city. Yeah, and I think so that'll be a trend, absolutely, that's going to happen in the commercial office space.
Co-working, I think, is going to be a bigger movement. I mean, it's big globally, but it's also going to be even bigger here in Australia.
Just a quick reminder, you can access our show notes, including links to all of the resources we talk about, on our website, which is propertyplannerbuyerandprofessor.com.au.
One of the trends that I've enjoyed seeing slow down while we talk about COVID-inspired change is the escape to the regions. And, you know, our regions are beautiful, and a lot of people make the decision to go to the regions for ideas that are independent of COVID. But we had a lot of Melburnians having a bit of a panic and escaping to the regions or making the decision to escape. And I think I was quoted back in September when a journo asked me about inquiry and people's willingness to move. I said 60% of my inquiry is about escaping to a region. And Macedon Ranges was a really strong draw card, so everyone wanted to go to Kyneton, Woodend, Macedon. And whether it was Surf Coast, Ballarat, Bendigo, Castlemaine, it felt like a lot of people wanted to escape and there was a little bit of a threat of an exodus. And what I've noted is, first and foremost, that inquiry has slowed right down. It's back to where it's always been, which is about 5% for me. We get a few people wanting to, you know, move to Geelong or Ballarat or whatever. And it feels more baseline, but not only that, people who had engaged with us to do the move or were in dialogue with us have come off that idea. And even just yesterday, I checked back in and had a couple of Zoom meetings with locals that were planning to do the move, and they've downgraded their budget because they don't want to leave the city. And they've now said, let's just have a weekend or a retreat or an Airbnb. We don't actually now want to sell up and leave the city. Really interesting.
Yeah, and I think that's sort of one of the things that's somewhat reflected in this month's CoreLogic numbers, where for the first time since the pandemic began, the capital cities, combined capital cities, have outperformed combined regional area. So they've just been, I think, 0.1% behind in February, but now they're 2.8% growth for March versus 2.5%. One of my predictions is that gap will start to widen again like it historically has. And I think if I was going to be backing, and this is no different to what I thought prior to COVID, two horses in the long run, it'll be Melbourne and Sydney for all the reasons that we've discussed previously. As things get back to normal, they're going to continue to have the outperforming companies, the outperforming incomes. And, you know, that's a bit of a movement that has been occurring for some time around the world, with superstar cities actually getting a disproportionate level of investment. It's not necessarily a fair equation, but it does positively impact residential property prices if you're investing in those residential property prices.
I'd be interested to hear your take on how long you think this frenzy is going to last. In my opinion, the property market will continue to go up for at least another couple of years, but this frenzy won't last forever. You know, when I say frenzy, it's like you've done all your research, you go to the auction or you go to make an offer, and then you find out later that the property sold for 10 or 20% more, which is just unrealistic and unsustainable. That sort of frenzy, that sort of heat in the market won't be there by the end of this year. I think it'll just naturally blow itself out. But whilst interest rates remain so low, whilst the supply of property is also so low, I think we're going to see property prices continue to go up, maybe not as at the same rate they've been going in the last 3 months, but certainly they'll be going up. And, you know, other than Sydney and Melbourne, which had really had a great decade, unlike the rest of Australia, capital cities in Australia and the regional areas, we're just really playing catch-up. But Sydney and Melbourne have done really well the last 10 years, whereas the other six capital cities and the regionals, we've been lagging behind. But now we're the rest of Australia is catching up. What do you reckon, Kate? What's your read on it?
I think there's a lot of wisdom in what you're saying, Pete, that unless we have some lending changes, you know, macro-prudential-led changes, I don't see this dissipating for a while. And the issue that we've got is that the differential between where we've assessed market values and what our current borrowing capacity is still some fat there. So once that fat dissipates, so once people stretch up their spending power to the limit of their borrowing capacity, then clearly it can't get any higher. Now, the contingent that are really impacting this market are owner-occupiers, first-home buyers and upgraders, and downsizers. So we're feeling it from all angles. The investors are out of the market. Really, they're a tiny blip. So it can be said, particularly for Melbourne, that the first home buyers who saved more money over COVID, and there was a lot of saving going on during lockdown, have heightened borrowing capacity as a direct reflection of their increased deposit. And we've also got parents helping out. And what we also know is from a generational point of view, baby boomers are inheriting money from late parents. So there's money slushing around there. I think unless we have some changes at the lending level, it will take quite a while for that gap between spending power and borrowing capacity to be eliminated. And you're right, it'll eventually run out. But I think we've got a lot of steam and a lot of heat to go. And it pains me to say it. Now, regulators will probably get serious when they look at 3 and 4 month old data and say, gee whiz, why didn't we talk to someone at the coalface? But I think we've got a bit more of this to go. And what we all know is winters in capital cities are slower for listings. So Brisbane might not be as impacted as Sydney and Melbourne, but when it gets cold, especially down here, vendors don't like to list. They hang out for spring. Spring might give our buyers a little bit of a softer opportunity to get in, but I think competition's going to remain pretty heady, at least for the foreseeable future, unless we have any macro-prudential changes.
Dave, Kate meant something about lending, and I know a large component of your business is mortgages. Do you reckon the relaxation of the mortgage lending guidelines, which has only been in for a week or so, is going to have any impact, positive impact on the property market?
If the lending guidelines are relaxed further, as they propose to do, I think it'll be negligible, to be honest. I think because loans will get approved faster, that could have an impact. So the volume could increase even further in terms of the number of loans as opposed to the loan size, because it won't necessarily, I think what will change, it's not going to change borrowing capacity. And borrowing capacity, as we've talked about before, is guaranteed. If borrowing capacity increases by 10%, then property values are going to increase by 10%. So what it's going to do is speed up the ability to assess loans faster, which I think most people want. You know, it's the paperwork that's slowing everyone down, and that's the banks that are concerned, probably rightly so, because the laws are so stringent. There's laws in ASIC, there's laws with APRA, both around responsible lending, and there's hundreds of pages of hard-to-interpret, opaque regulation that, you know, the banks are trying to follow. So I think it won't increase borrowing capacity, but it could increase volume, which can push up property prices to some degree. One of the things where we might get a big second gust of wind in the sales of the residential property market is when borders open up again to immigration. And that will be really interesting to see. Whether that comes, you know, let's say macro-prudential regulation has come in, I think that could still keep a property market going even beyond some level of macro-prudential regulation. We also know that, you know, even once the macro-prudential regulation is put in place to potentially make it more difficult to access finance, that change doesn't happen overnight. You know, it happens over a period of time. So the market's going to keep running right through to 2022. And when migration happens again, Australia's going to be absolutely a destination nation, even potentially more so. And we've been a destination nation, say that too many times in a row, you might get tongue twister. But post the global financial crisis, post World War II, you know, it's going to be, I think, the same post the pandemic being under control around the world.
Agreed. Increased overseas migration, increased international student is certainly going to keep our property market and our economy going for a while. So I don't think that overseas migration will start this year, not in earnest, but, you know, next year when most other countries are vaccinated, we're vaccinated, then you'll see some huge intake of overseas migrants and students. I reckon international students will be back in their masses for 2022, the start of 22. I don't think we'll see many the beginning of the second semester. Yeah, so look, watch this space. As I said before, I haven't seen, you know, the market like this ever. I have spoken to a real estate agent who's been selling real estate all his life, and he said the last time he saw something like this was back in the early 1980s. And the joke was, if you had a property that was listed at too high a price, it would sell in 3 weeks' time because the market would catch up to it. And we haven't seen that sort of thing for a while. So it's certainly a very interesting thing to observe. I've been trying to participate. Like, I've been trying to buy myself, but I just can't come to paying, you know, 10% more than what I really think it's worth, because, I mean, the optimist says, oh, she'll be right because, you know, in several months it'll be up by 10% anyway. All right, and it probably will be, but there's no guarantee that it will be. It's guaranteed that I've paid 10% more than I should have, but there's no guarantee that it'll be worth 10% more. You know, unknown reasons. We've got trade problems with our major trading partner. You know, that's a black cloud hanging over us.
Absolutely, yeah.
So we just, rather than whinging that I can't buy, I'm just sitting back happy because I got multiple investment properties and, you know, they're going up in value. So when the steam comes out of the market, then I'll hop back in.
I think it's a really difficult question for anyone to navigate when they're buying their home, and particularly first-home buyers. I've met all kinds of people and personalities, ranging from excited optimists to conspiracy theorists and beyond. And so many people are saying the same thing as you, Pete. I don't want to pay 10% more. And the question I ask them is, what's the worst thing that could happen if your job security is high, you know what you can spend, and it's within your grasp? They're always scared about buying something that loses value shortly after. No one wants to time it that they've bought at the peak of the market. If it's a home, though, and you're not selling it, you're not crystallising a loss. And markets are fluid. So in 5 years' time, you would anticipate that that asset is worth more than what you paid for it, even if you bought at the peak of the market. And I don't have a crystal ball that has a warranty. So we have to look at this objectively and say to ourselves, if we think that the market could deteriorate, and we genuinely believe we know what the drivers are for that market deterioration, well, then we've got to back our own theory and wait it out and wait for the market to drop. But if we don't have that confidence, the risk that we take by holding out is that we're priced out of a market that we could have bought into. And I have to have that conversation on a daily basis with inquiries and new buyers and people that are nervous about the tough market conditions. And people always say to me, oh, I missed the boat. Well, I bought my house for $802,000 back in 2012, and the person before me paid $32,000 or something of that. Like, did I miss the boat? Well, no, I wasn't about to buy in 1968. So markets are fluid.
You raise a very good point there. If you're going to be buying and holding for the long term, then, yeah, like you pay a little bit extra now, it's not going to be a big deal. But maybe I should have explained, like I'm at the stage of my property investment life where I'm not looking to accumulate for the long term, but just to get in and out, you know, by adding value generally through subdivision potential or developing is what I'm looking at. But, yeah, but if you're in it for the long term, which is generally the best way to be buying property for the long term, then it shouldn't be an issue. Now, the other thing that I've tried to do is, so I've gone to realestate.com, and normally I list newest to oldest listings, right? Because I want to see what's on there. What I did recently was go the opposite way, oldest to newest, to see what stuff's been on the market for a long time. You know, everything else has been pretty hot. Let's see what I can do here. So I've been contacting the real estate agents because the ad is still up there, and now I find out that these properties are under offer. You know, it's too late. You know, and hindsight's a wonderful thing. You know, there was a great development site in the beachside suburb of Christie's Beach, and we do our numbers now, and the asking price that they were asking 3 years ago was too much. But the asking price hasn't moved, but the market has. So today it's worth it. You know, like I said earlier, hindsight's a wonderful thing. We're all geniuses in hindsight. If I knew back then what was going to happen today, yes, I would have bought it. But
that's anyway. A really good tip, Pete. I actually love that. I remember a few years ago when we had a reasonably hot market, I always, when I'm doing a client online search, I will work all the way back to the end of the last page. If that happens to be page 19, then so be it. Because you never know. Mm. The sale that's sitting there just floating around, you can assume that it's sold and the agency's been slack and hasn't taken it down, or that there's something wrong with it. But the reality is, once a property gets to page 10, it's not getting the same clicks. And sometimes there's nothing wrong with it. It's just that it was overpriced or access was difficult or whatever it was. And I remember picking a property and one of my colleagues said, oh, no, that one's been around forever. It's like on page 50. And I made the phone call and the agent said, oh, yeah, look, I haven't had an inquiry on that in ages. I'll give them a buzz. Well, the situation had changed. They're a bit more motivated. They're happy for me to get through. And I made a really tough offer and I secured the property for a great price. So it's a wonderful tip.
Excellent. That which works in the real world. There you go. So you've succeeded in that. Fantastic. But we've only got a couple more minutes to go before we come up with our gold nuggets. So, Dave, is there any final comments you wanted to make on our property market update episode?
Well, I was just thinking, you know, your point I think is a good caveat to make, Pete, is I was going to make a joke and check if you were getting out a 30-year home loan or not. And so the time frame factor has to come into the consideration of what you're willing to buy, because and pay, because I do think on the level of probabilities, the likelihood that the market's going to keep rising for some time, and if you're holding it for the longer term, probably, you know, today is the best a better time to buy than in a month's time or 3 months' time. So that was all I was, well, one of the things I was thinking while I was listening to both of you two.
Yeah, would they give me a 30-year loan? Probably not.
You'd just you'd talk about your exit strategy, Craig.
That's right. Kate, what about you? Any final comments on our property market update episode?
Yeah, we've all chatted to the CoreLogic documentation, which is great because it's consistent. And, you know, when you're reading the same data provider stuff on a monthly basis, you can see rates of change. There were two that sparked my interest. The first one was the annual change in rents. Now, for houses and units, there's a slightly different story because Melbourne and Sydney aren't really recovering well with the change in rental unit prices. But when we look across the board at all dwellings, and in particular houses, we can see some of our cities are really popping up there and surprising us, namely Darwin. Now, what that says is the jobs in Darwin are bountiful right now and people are jumping onto them, and there's not enough houses for workers, because Darwin's annual change in rents for houses is looking like it's close to 18%, and for units it's over 14%. That's a massive change in rent through a pandemic for a city that's been suffering for a while, and it says that there's some valuable stuff in the ground and offshore, obviously. Now, the other point that I'll make is when we look at listings, total listings, rolling 28-day count, if we look at new listings, we're not doing too bad. We're back up there with previous years, more or less, nationally. But when we look at total listings, we're less than half. What that says is the take-up of new listings and buyers pouncing onto them is through the roof.
Yeah. Very, very interesting times. Yeah. So thank you very much, Kate. Thank you very much, Dave. Look forward not only to our next market update, which will be in a month's time, but also next week's episode. And talking about next week's episode, we're looking for more listener questions. So if you've got any questions that you would like us to answer, please send them in, and we would be more than happy to have a go at answering them. So please don't go yet, because we've still got our gold nuggets from Dave and Kate.
If you've enjoyed our podcast, leave a review on iTunes and share the episode with your friends.
Now it's time for us to go mining for our gold nugget property tip of the day.
Kate, what's your gold nugget?
Well, my gold nugget is for our listeners that have got a bit out of this episode. And if you're keen to get some insights into information that breaks quickly, jump onto CoreLogic. They've got some free reports, and you can click onto the website and register for these things to land in your inbox, because we certainly get a lot of good intel, and it's the basis for our discussions around data often.
Thank you, Kate. Dave?
Look, I'll just share the Reserve Bank met yesterday, and once again, they didn't increase the cash rate. We are recording on the 7th of April. And once again, they reiterated that the cash rate, they expect it to stay 0.1% until 2024. So that means that interest rates are likely to be very low for a long time. And that is one of the underlying, if not the main reason, the property prices are going up. So I think, you know, in all likelihood, property prices are going to keep going up for some time, subject to macroprudential regulation stepping in. But even then, there's no guarantee how quickly that'll slow down the market. So we're likely to have low rates for the foreseeable future until inflation gets back into the target band of 2 to 3%, which means unemployment probably needs to have a 4 in front of it. It's currently 5.8%. But good news on that front is job ads are 23% higher than they were 12 months ago, and we've got the highest number of job ads since 2008. So overall, you know, the economy is certainly tracking in the right direction.
Excellent. Well, thank you very much, Dave, and thank you, Kate, and thank you, listeners. And we look forward to catching up with you in a week's time.
Sounds
bye for
great.
Now.
See you later.
See you, everyone. If you've enjoyed this episode, take a listen to episodes number 6, What Determines Your Property Strategy? Episode 21, Why Price Point Should Determine Location and Strategy?
episode 24, how your mortgage strategy shapes your ability to hold property and how it could pay off for decades to come. Episode 39, why Sydney and Melbourne outperform. Episode 42, dissecting 10 years of CoreLogic data, capital cities and regional areas. And episode 63, setting yourself up to purchase with confidence and why getting your pre-approval in place is more critical than ever.
Thank you for joining the property planner, David Johnston, whose company Property Planning Australia provides the only independent pure planning advisory in Australia that does not buy or sell property, insurance, investment or super product.
And the property buyer, Kate Bacos, recently awarded Buyer's Agent of the Year and an owner of an independent buyer's agency in Melbourne's Inner West. And of course, the property professor, Peter Kalizos, Australia's leading property university lecturer, Chairman of Property Investment Professionals of Australia and seasoned investor and developer.
We've really enjoyed delivering this podcast and we'd love you to join us on our podcast webpage at propertyplannerbuyerandprofessor.com.au or our Facebook page. Feel free to send us any questions and Dave, Pete and I will answer them for you.
So until next time, remember that each property decision you make is leading you towards your ideal lifestyle.
Everything we talk about in this episode is general in nature and should not be considered to be financial advice. We've put a lot of effort into making sure the information is accurate, but please don't rely on this information to make a decision. If you're looking for specific advice, please seek the help of a specialist and remember, it's important you determine your trusted advisors are independent.